wouldn't it be nice? Take one. Do it. Take it. It's like this. Boom! 2, 3, 4, bottom. Okay? First beat on the last bar of the intro. You'll go boom, 2, 3, 4, bop out, and then start the song, right? Let's go.
Would you like me to lower the phones? Do you need them as loud, or would you? But you only need it for the intro anyway, right? You only need it for the intro anyway, right? Okay, wouldn't it be nice? Take two. Hit the downbeat on the fourth bar.
Word.
That's what he wants.
It's like this, and I'll tell you if you want to just boom, you hit the downbeat, and then Frankie over there who's looking. Oh, hi, Frank. Then Frankie is like boom, 2, 3, bada. Starts it, right? Okay, here we go. Now listen, Hal, let me just tell you. Fourth bar, you go bow, and then go ba-bow to start the thing, right? And Frankie, you just come right in with that, hey, Frankie, you come in with this thing, with the thing on. Wah-choo-choo, 3, 4, wah-choo-choo. So have those ready. You're not playing in the intro. Just come in with those. Here we go, come on.
Take four.
Okay, wouldn't it be nice? Take five. Come on, Hal, let's go, please.
All right, there, of course, are the Beach Boys. Wouldn't it be nice? And you can hear at the top of that, Brian Wilson talking to the band, talking to Hal Blaine. And that, you know, I think that is my second favorite single of all time. Sometimes it's my first favorite. Anyway, we're talking about Hal Blaine today, and Dennis Dykin joins me on the phone. Dennis, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Mike, and I'm so glad you called me. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
I'm glad we could do this. I mean, I know that you and I have spoken, you know, in diners and off the air about Hal Blaine for, I'm not exaggerating, hours of our lives. Tell me when, I know that you contacted Hal way, way, many, many years ago. Why and how?
Why? Because his playing meant so much to me, as I'll be repeating what so many other drummers have been saying for years, and I think Max Weinberg coined it best. He blew his mind when he found out that 12 or however many of his favorite drummers turned out to be Hal Blaine. So many of us drummers and just casual listeners grew up listening to radio in the 60s and 70s and were moved by the groove, and hey, that rhymes, of certain records that we may not have realized were helmed by session players. In some cases, session players that subbed, I guess is the word, for the regular musicians in a name band, let's say like the Beach Boys or the Association, bands that had an image with their own players, like Dennis Wilson on drums and Ted Blueshell from the Association, just to use those as examples. Anyway, growing up, I was so into these records. I remember buying the Association album, Inside Out, in 1967, the one that had Wendy and Never My Love, in stereo and separating the left to right so I could hear the drums and learn from them. And I was so into the sound and the feel and the playing on those cuts. And I just said, wow, I am so into this drummer in the Association, Ted Blueshell. And of course, years go by, and we all learn that the band members in these groups may not have played on all of their own records, and they were studio players. So when I finally learned that Hal had played on a great percent of some of my favorite records that have been inspiring me all my life, when I found out it was Hal, I came to a certain age where I said, I just got to write this guy a letter. And I did. A friend of mine got me his address, and I wrote him basically a fan letter. I think at the time I was even aspiring to do some article or I think a little booklet about him, a fanzine, something to that extent. So I wrote a letter to him. He was living in Hollywood at the time. And I think it was within a week I got a reply from him. And it just blew me away that here, this guy whose work had meant so much to me took the time to respond. And that's how we, and in that letter, he includes his phone number. This is 1982. And I learned by staying in touch with him and talking with other people, he was a people person. He loved, number one, he loved the recognition, because when you think about 1982, his career had already peaked, I guess you would say, by the late 60s, even though he was working well into the 70s. But by that time in 82, it's way before the internet or general knowledge about a lot of these the session players and just the way things go in the music business. I'm sure he wasn't getting a ton of fan mail or pats on the back from people out there. So he relished that, and he loved to stay in touch with people, and he gave. He was a real giving spirit. So it was easy to stay in touch with him and become his friend.
Yeah, and then over the years, as you were traveling with Smithereens and stuff, you always kept in touch with him. It's kind of a great story. Until fairly recently, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with him last year. I couldn't make it out for his 90th birthday party, which was just in February of this year. But I was actually on a roundtable phone interview with him last year, and he sounded great. And 2 years ago, I actually interviewed him for a piece I wrote for Modern Drummer magazine. There was a feature issue on the year 1967, which was a great year for Hal. He was at the peak of his powers, I would say, at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting that just 2 weeks ago he had a birthday party and he looked fine. I mean, he was 90 when he died, but it was just a few weeks ago and there was a lot of pictures. It was at the Baked Potato and, of course, star-studded turnout for that. Yeah, I don't know. Starting with 1967 is kind of perfect. One of the things he worked on in 67 that I did not know was Love Forever Changes. He's on part of that record. Of course, did not chart, but some of the records, I mean, we can't list every record he played on that charted, but just since you uttered the phrase 1967, he had a number three hit with Bobby V. And going through these lists, it's amazing. This is just interesting to me how when you listen to oldies radio, some people sort of have disappeared and some people stayed. And Bobby V, Come Back When You Grow Up, is just a song you never hear anymore, yet it went to number three. Frank and Nancy Sinatra, Something Stupid, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Him or Me, What's It Gonna Be, Scott McKenzie, Wear Flowers in Your Hair, The Association, like you said, Windy, Never My Love, Fifth Dimension, Up, Up and Away, Grassroots, Let's Live for Today, Mamas and the Papas, Dedicated to the One I Love, and Creek Alley, Monkeys, Little Bit You, Little Bit Me, Supremes, Happening. Those were all top 10 hits in 1967. Of course, all have drums. So imagine the number of top 40 hits is probably that time. Five or six, maybe.
Yeah, I would not say that's outside the realms of possibility. That 67, he was on a lot of great records, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's very possible.
Yeah, I mean, I said this before that, and I don't know if it's true or not, but he in some way is the epitome of what studio musician was, and maybe the most prolific, maybe not, but certainly I think the best studio musician there will ever be.
I couldn't disagree with that. You know, he had, I mean, just from his track record alone, how can you name anybody else that comes close? Maybe Earl Palmer, the other great dude, actually the L.A., New Orleans, later L.A. studio drummer who recorded so much and actually gave Hal his start in Los Angeles, but he played on an awful lot of stuff. And in this day and age, I don't know if anybody else if there's any other statistics, but that would challenge that. But I think he was the epitome because he could play. You know, he played on so many different styles and so many different types of records. He could just walk into the studio, look at what was put in front of him and get the job done, but make it feel so good. That was, I think, the gift of any accomplished musician that can work that much and have such a long-lasting career. It's not just about chops. It's not just about ability and technique. It's about feel and the feel that you inject into the piece of music you're interpreting. And consider you're doing, in Hal's case, on the average, 12 to 18-hour days.
I think for some of the sessions, it's interesting that he would come in and find a piece on sheet music, and Hal read sheet music and could come in and just do it off the sheet music. And then probably in the same day, he might walk in and have a more of a green producer who didn't know anything and expected the session musicians to sort of work up an arrangement, you know, from a lead sheet or whatever. And I think that creativity, you know, was part of what was expected from those guys. And it also blows my mind. I mean, I think I said this to one of the studio musicians I interviewed, was that it's kind of interesting that a band writes a song, they rehearse it, maybe they play it on the road for a year, and still for some reason, Hal, who'd never heard the song, could come in and make a more interesting record in 3 hours than that band who had lived with the song for months.
Wow, it's an interesting thought there. You know, I think part of the reason for that perhaps happening is that the guys in the so-called wrecking crew were working daily, so much, like I said, 12 to 18, sometimes 20-hour days, and sometimes weekends. So day after day after day, week after week, month after month, you are so well-oiled and so in tune, not just with what's going on in the current-day pop world, the then-current-day pop world, because you're helping to create it, number one, but your instincts and your what's the word I'm looking for? Your wherewithal to inject something different and special is so heightened, you know, because of all that daily practice.
Yeah, it's funny because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you want if you're trying to make a record that sounds like the top 40 sound, and you are the top 40 sound, as we just sort of, with it, just that list from records from 1967, yeah, I mean, that was the sound, you know? So it became a thing. When I interviewed Bones Howe, he said something like, you know, that Howe's time wasn't perfect, but that there was something about, like what you said, just the feel, which is why he always wanted Hal around. And then when I interviewed Steve Barry, he said something interesting, which was he would make Hal change the tuning of his drums because he didn't want, because, you know, he might produce 10 groups with Hal playing drums. He didn't want them all to sound like they had the same drummer. And finally, Hal left a set of drums there and said, okay, do whatever you want to these. I'll leave them here, and this will just always be the set I play when I come here. And now Steve Barry's son has that set of drums.
Wow, that's cool. And that's an interesting point and pretty astute on Steve Barry's part, I would say.
He's
still getting Hal's feel and talent, but right, he's getting a different sound, which back then when so many, you know, you read, I'm sure you've got this from a lot of the producers you've interviewed. The big thing in the 60s when it was, there were so many great records being made, producers would ultimately, they're trying to create or add a sound or an element to a record that would make it stand out from all the others. That was a big challenge. So, yeah, to have a different drum sound but still have Hal's feel, it's a good move.
Yeah, it's a good move. Let's talk about, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but like he had some down times, right? He had some times. I mean, I know he was married more than once is a very accurate statement. I mean, how do you know much about his personal life?
I know that his first wife died, and then he was married four times after that. I don't know a lot of details about it. I think I used to, and I forgot, honestly, because we would chat a lot on the phone, and he would talk about his life, and I do remember him saying he was kind of a sucker for blondes.
He used to make a lot of divorce jokes and sort of alimony jokes, you know?
Right. And of course, I think he does talk about it in the film, The Wrecking Crew, that his, I guess it was his last marriage, or the one that did him in, there was that one divorce that seemingly came out of nowhere. He did not see it coming, and she took him for everything. So that was sad. I have no idea what went on behind closed doors, but it just, something didn't seem right about it, you know.
And there was definitely something about Hal in the studio that made him a leader, I think, of that group of people.
Yeah, well, everybody loved Hal. He had a penchant for cutting the tension at sessions because he was a great joke teller, and he always found the right moment if things were getting a little tense. He would come out with something to break the spell. I think on one of those Phil Spector sessions, I think it's Be My Baby, Phil talks, he interjects on the talk back mic about, come on guys, you want a big bonus at Christmas, don't you? And in so many words, and they're going for another take and the musicians are kind of distracted or they're chatting among themselves and you hear Hal say, come on, guys, it's Christmas. And then they go for another take. I mean, that's just it's not a full-on joke, but that was his persona in the studio. He was always cutting up. And when you say leader, too, but in a technical sense, I think he was often a session leader. And according to the union, the AFM, every session had to have a designated leader. And that person would also get double scale for a given session. Even if you were the only player, let's say you were doing an overdub, this happened to me once and I couldn't believe it. I was adding drums to a track. It was a union session. And when I got my check, I was the default leader because I was the only player on the session. Like I said before, he was a people person. People loved him. And he was a leader and a contractor. He would be the guy hired for some sessions, for many sessions, I believe, to choose all the other players, the other musicians for a given cut. He would know who was best. Let's say it was a Bones House session, and he knew the guys that Bones liked, so he would call those guys or somebody that was able to deliver the type of thing that, that Bones was looking for. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that I, you know, whenever you ask these guys how much they got paid for a session, and I think the sessions were 3 hours, that they would, you know, some of them, depending on when they started, you know, it starts at like $18.50 or these kind of strange amounts, and $35, you know, were, you know, it doesn't get too much higher than that. But when you were the leader and the booker and, you know, working 20 hours a day or whatever, I guess it added up because Hal made a lot of money. He drove Rolls Royces and, you know, had toys over the year. Have you ever heard his CD called Badoom?
Oh, for sure I have, yeah.
This is a CD where he just tells jokes, yeah.
Yeah. But let me backtrack for a session.
Yeah.
For a session. Boy. For a second. Freudian slip. $35 in 1964, $35 an hour, not per session, but per hour, ain't A when you think about it, right?
No, yeah. And, it's still not terrible, yeah.
And so if you're working a three-hour session, you're making over $100 there, and you do that 3, 4, 5 times a day, 5, 6 days a week, that adds up real quick, actually, when you think about it, for 64, 65, 66. Yeah, and in Hal's case, I don't know at what point he started demanding double scale and eventually triple, I believe. So that's how he was able to have a Rolls Royce. He had a really nice house, too. I hadn't never been to the house that he lived in the 60s and 70s, but that was the address that I sent my initial fan letter to, and I looked the address up, and it's quite palatial. Beautiful house above where the Hollywood Bowl was. I guess it was a good location to get to all the studios quickly, too. I think that house later was purchased by Ben Stiller. I don't know if he still lives there or not.
Oh, that's cool. So I think one of the ways he was able to do this, and I guess you might know more about this, is that he had many drum sets, and he had a guy who would sort of be one studio ahead setting up the drums so that when he walked in, he just needed to sit down and play.
Correct.
Yeah.
I think he had 3 kits, if I'm not mistaken, all identical. And his guy, his name was Rick Fouché, I believe was his last name, who passed away a couple of years ago, Hal loved this man and depended on him so much. Hal would get his session bookings for the week or whatever, and he would give them to Rick. So Rick knew that, okay, if Hal was going to be at Gold Star at 8 a.m., that Rick would be there beforehand with the kit set up, leaves the kit for Hal to do the session. Meanwhile, brings the kit number 2 to Western for the next session, sets up while Hal is doing the session at Gold Star, and on and on and on. And this fellow Rick also maintained Hal's kits. Hal went into detail talking about he would just take them apart and put moleskin in between all the lugs and everything, so there was no noise. I mean, he was a big part of Hal's story, really, the guy behind the scenes. But it's just it's the only way a guy like Hal could work as much as he did. And I think he was the first guy to employ somebody to do his cartage and setup and everything. I often wonder about studio sessions in those days, how guys, if they didn't have their own the roadie, so to speak, how could they facilitate doing that work? I mean, okay, so I'm done. Let's say the session is 9 to 12. So does that mean you get there 8:30 and you set up, and then you do the session, then afterwards, you know, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it takes to unload, and what a lot of work that was. I know Bobby Graham in London told me that's what he had to do. It's incredible. And then in some cases, find parking and all that.
I know there's a certain point in Hal's career where he got known for using what he called the Monster Kit, or what became known as the Monster Kit, and it's a drum set with, I don't know, I want to say 10, you know, or a lot more tom-toms than then two or three, which is sort of the more usual number. And I always feel like, in some ways, he just must have added that to change the sound, to keep it fresh, to try to offer something new. I don't know. It's not like my ideal type of drum set. I think if you listen to like a Cherokee Nation song, you can hear that. But what did you think about that? And because there's lots of pictures of him with this drum set. Did he like playing that? Did he use it a lot? Did he use it correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I play a four-piece kit. Sometimes I'll add a second floor tom to make a five-piece kit. But I think you can do a lot with four pieces. But Hal was always thinking ahead and looking ahead and knew that producers were looking for something different. I think it was brilliant. And it really it came about in 1967, I think, is when he first developed it. It sounds about right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it's probably 8 to 10 toms in addition to his four-piece kit. And he did use it well. I don't think it ever got in the way of the music or the song. If you analyze it, I think you'll find that that it really worked. The first record was that I think put that sound on the map was The Snake by Al Wilson. Know that record, right?
Yeah.
And that really, it adds a different flavor to the record. I don't think it's bad in any way. And then sometimes he'll use those toms, but he may not go around them necessarily. Like on Stone Soul Picnic, for example, a great example, where he just uses them for single hits. Going into coming out of some of the choruses, if you listen to that, or there's a lot of different examples where he doesn't always use it just for that total round big fill thing. So,
right.
And I think it was born out of him using timbales sometime prior to the Monster Kit, even on Windy by the Association. Those high pitched fills are high pitched timbales. Or Pray for Surf by the Honeys, if you listen to that. He has timbales tuned real low. So he was looking for different timbres, different sounds, going back to the early 60s. There's a picture of him at Gold Star where he could spin, probably from 63. I don't know what the session was, but he's got the timbales there. So anyway, yeah, that was his vision to create something like that. And maybe what it wrought is another question.
Right. Well, one of the things that you just made me think of was, like, his playing on Windy is something he did a lot where he helps add another hook to the song. You know, the thing that you remember, the thing that you hum along, instead of just the drums being part of the rhythm section, very musically, Hal often added something that was the hook. And another thing that I recognized that he did was very often he will, like, if he's got a fill going into to start the chorus or something, he'll play it every time so that it becomes like a guitar part or like something else that's repeated. It just becomes, it's a hook. Yeah.
You're right. And in the case of Windy, I guess you're talking about the part that he does that leads into the right when he goes.
But exactly.
If you listen to it, He does something every time there, but he does vary it slightly,
yes,
which makes it even cooler, you know. But no, you're right. All those guys in the wrecking crew or any good studio players back then that were making a lot of records, you're right. Their individual parts, even if it was sometime even just one moment in a record and it wasn't repeated, it creates a thing that you can't wait to hear, you know.
Yeah. In the Smithereens, you have made very modern-sounding records, very contemporary-sounding records. What's the most number of microphones used on your drum kit, your five- or four-piece drum kit, do you think?
I never counted them, you know. I know.
But it could be a dozen, right?
Oh, I would say, yeah, because let's just think for a second. Top and bottom of snare, toms and overheads. Yeah, it can get up there.
He could, right, but so often, and this is my point, is that you'll see these photos of Hal And maybe it's Gold Star, because I think that room is very small to what people think of as a studio. And everybody's crowded in one room, and it looks like sometimes you can only see one mic on the drums. There might be another one on the kick drum or something, but very often these hit records have one or two or three mics on the drums, period.
Yeah, that's true. But recording was done in a very different fashion in those days, and they weren't afraid of bleeding, you know, where the sounds will leak in from other instruments to create a whole picture. It was a different mentality.
Well, I definitely think that because they were making these records virtually live and then maybe sometimes just putting the vocals over, yeah, they know what it was going to sound like. There was never this idea that we'll fix it later, we'll change it later, and so they had to be able to have everything separated because they knew they weren't going to do that. It was done, you know, when those guys walked out of the room, yeah.
Phil Spector's in the control booth, and what he's hearing is the final picture, pretty much. You know, he might have been putting all those players onto one track, and yeah, you walk out of there, and there's your record. Yeah, add the vocals, maybe strings later, but it's a great way to record. I've done it a few times, and I just love it, you know.
One of the things that when I try to explain Hal to people who maybe don't care as much as I do or don't see the significance as much as I do, and believe me, that's fine. As long as you like the music, it really doesn't matter if you know who Hal is, you know? And I think that's sort of Hal would tell you that. He's just there to serve the song. But when I try to describe it to people, I sort of say, the Phil Spector sound, you know, if you say this guy was the drummer on the Phil Spector sound, to me that is like a career-making credit to have. Or to say, you know, he was the Beach Boys guy during that time when Dennis went on the road and wasn't in the studio and Brian stayed in. That's all Hal. And for me, again, you know, Pet Sounds, that is just a career-making credit. He's also Elvis's drummer, right? Maybe one of the most most famous music makers ever, right? That's a career-making credit. And also, he touched Sinatra's world. All of those, you know, I mean, and that's nothing. You know, that is like 1% of his output. It's kind of almost an overwhelming thing. There's some interesting stuff I read somewhere about when they first started working with Brian, and Brian was so young that I won't say that they had their doubts, but it's just interesting to read everyone's accounts of watching Brian get the respect and come of age in the studio. And I know that Brian and Hal were really close.
Yes, they were, yeah. I think, it took them a few beats, but in short order, they realized that Brian was somebody special and they looked forward to working with him because it was going to be great music, perhaps a little challenging, but they were going to walk out of the session feeling like this was not just another pop record. Brian, there's that great story you probably have heard. At one point, I think it was in the 70s, where Brian was going through some head trip, where he decided he was going to ditch his gold records. So he put them in a cardboard box, drove to Hal's house, and gave him to Hal. He said, Hal, I want you to have these. and Hal said he wouldn't accept them, but I think he went to say goodbye, and then Brian just left him on his porch or something. So, but they know they had a real deep mutual admiration society going, and that, you know, it's how can you say it? Certainly Hal is there to have a career and make as much money as he can, but he cared, you know, he really cared about doing a good job, making his mark, making a hit record, making good music, you know, and he cared about people. And I think that's why those records, that's why he played on so many great records, worked with so many great artists, because what he put into the grooves of those records was a reflection of his love of life, of his love of mankind, if you want to put it that way. I think it's those records feel so good because he had that spirit. And in turn, those records make us feel glad we're alive. I really feel that way when I'm walking in a supermarket or if I hear it on the car radio or wherever I might be. And let's say, Be My Baby comes on or even a track like That's Life, which I think is a killer groove and a killer feel. It lightens my step, lightens my load. And now you can say that about a lot of records by a lot of people when you hear them, but I say across the board, any Hal track will get you through the day a little easier.
How interesting. You're absolutely right. And sort of as I alluded to earlier, we sort of take it for granted, which we sort of should. But at times like this, yes, we need to sort of stop and look back and sort of see the big picture of how this stuff got made and who made it and be thankful for them. Well, one of the things I thought was interesting this morning as I was getting ready to talk to you is that I was looking on YouTube and there's almost no footage of Hal playing the drums live or in the studio. There's no footage of Hal playing the drums. I mean, there's two or three instances you can sort of see over and over, but they were all locked in the studio, like you said, 12 hours a day. Yeah. They were not on TV. They were not out playing live. So you don't get to see it, which for me is a shame.
It is a shame. There are some things that I've seen, but I haven't seen them since. Like, I think the first time I actually saw any moving image of Hal was probably in the late 70s or early 80s. On The Tonight Show, he was playing with John Denver at the time. And I remember I was really into Hal at that point, and I'm watching The Tonight Show, and there's John Denver, and he introduces the band, and on drums, Hal Blaine. And it blew my mind to actually see, oh, that's Hal. That's him up there for real. But there is that footage of that surfaced in the last couple of years, that Beach Boys Good Vibrations footage, which is really cool.
Yeah.
I know you know what I'm talking about. But that's kind of staged.
Yes,
but you still see how he holds the sticks. I remember seeing, and I don't think this has surfaced either, there was footage of him, color footage, mid-60s of him in the studio with the Mamas and Papas. But I don't think that's come up. I haven't searched for it in a while. There's footage of him playing with Nancy Sinatra in Vegas. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, there's only those couple things. You're right. Isn't
it the Hollywood Bowl with Jan and Dean? You can sort of see that. You ever see? Yeah, he's great on that. Yeah, I think, am I right that he held his left hand, his snare drum hand, with the jazz grip?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think that it depended on the cut. And I believe he said when he played Spectre Sessions, he played match grip the other way, just the straight way. But yes, he did play the traditional grip quite frequently from photos I've seen. And maybe drummers can tell this, or astute music fans, you can kind of tell from a track how they're holding the stick when you listen to the track.
I can't tell.
Most of the time he was using the traditional or jazz grip, yeah.
You mentioned John Denver. He played on Thank God I'm a Country Boy, which was number one hit. I think his last number one, I may have this wrong, was Theme from Mahogany from Diana Ross from 76. Although I did notice in 77 he plays on the Three's Company theme that everybody knows. Everybody. The other 70s hits, I think The Way We Were from Barbra Streisand, number one. Half Breed, number one from Cher. Song Sung Blue, Neil Diamond. He plays on Ventura Highway by America, which was not number one, but a big hit. Never Rains in Southern California, big hit. Those are kind of the end of the 70s. By 71, he still had a lot of hits, but it sort of petered off. And do you think those guys understood that sort of self-contained bands were coming in? How do you think they all felt about that? How do you think Hal felt about that?
This morning I was going through, I have a folder of some of my Hal ephemera and correspondence through the years. And he says in the early 80s, he comments that something to the effect that he's surprised he's still getting called because in Hollywood here, he said, I should have been washed up 20 years ago, he said, knowing the way Hollywood discards people and goes for younger players or younger actors or whatever it is. So I guess they had that cognizance of that aspect of working. But, yeah, I think the self-contained groups, well, actually, thinking about that now, the self-contained groups came in with the Beatles pretty much and throughout the 60s. But those guys, that was their heyday. When I guess, I think I asked Hal about this, and he said, look, we didn't mind because we were playing on their records anyway.
Yeah, right. I think there's that great, I think it's the drummer from the Byrds who cried, you know, while they were cutting Mr. Tambourine Man, because he just, you know, was just hard to take to sit there and watch Hal do it, you know?
Sure. I'm sure at some point his boot heels were wandering outside of that studio, too. But,
Let's talk about Hal's solo records. I think, am I right that he has three? Drums Go-Go, Deuces, Tees, Roadsters and Drums, Drums Go-Go, and Psychedelic Percussions from 63, 66, and 67. They're all fun, interesting records. A lot of drums on them.
That first album, yeah, was done for RCA, and it was produced by David Gates, the Deuces Roadsters album.
Mm.
And that is a fun record. My favorite is Drums, Drums, A Go-Go. Whenever I do a fill-in on FMU, I use Hal's version of Topsy. It's called Topsy 65 as my intro music. Not my theme, but my intro music after I play my first set. And I love that record. It's pretty much his take on the Johnny Rivers live audience in the studio feel. And, it's really a fun, it is a fun record. I like it a lot. And the Psychedelic Percussion is really trippy, man. It's probably 67, 68, and he plays these really active drum grooves and overdubs. Or even, I think he might have had Emil Richards and some other percussionists come in and play all these zingy, wacky percussive sounds. That album is really cool. And he did do one other record, actually, called Have Fun, Play Drums, which was an instructional album. And if you get a chance to hear it, anybody out there, it's really cool because it's Hal speaking and demonstrating basic grooves and encouraging young players.
Never heard of this one, yeah.
Yeah, I could burn you a copy, Mike. That just is leading me to the fact that Hal was really encouraging to people and would correspond with young drummers. And did you ever know Bobby Lloyd Hicks, the great drummer who passed away a few years ago?
I never met him, but I saw him play drums a bunch.
Yeah, great, great drummer. He was a great guy. He was the Skeletons. He played later for a little while with NRBQ. And anyway, Bobby was a great guy and a good friend of mine and a fellow Hal nut. Now, Bobby wrote letters to Hal in the 60s and got responses. And I have copies of those, and I they're worth looking at, even just for a few brief excerpts I could read to you. This is from October 8th, 1966. As for the Beach Boys and Herb Albert, as a studio musician, I work freelance for just about everyone in the business, as I have mentioned in the past. When the Beach Boys were starting out, they needed studio guys that were aware of recording to help them. I was one of the guys. As they started making it big, they naturally kept using the same guys that did all the big hits with them. And then in parentheses, Brian is a genius, no matter who was in the studio. I recorded with the boys yesterday a song called My Childless Father or something like that. Which he's referring to childless father to the man.
Right.
So cool to see this. Anyway, we happen to get the so-called Beach Boys sound, and the boys go on the road and make the big money as a top attraction wherever they go. Half the time, they're on the road anyway, so they couldn't record. But by the same token, all the boys most generally on the sessions, we just augment the boys. This is nothing against the boys or their musicianship, just part of the business. Then he goes on about Herb Albert. It's just so cool to see him speaking in from those years, you know, in these letters and his advice. In another letter, he's encouraging Bob with his teenage band and just telling him how important it is to practice, how to tune his drums. So he was always very, he was nice to people. He cared about people. He loved people. He gave back.
That's right. He never became a hippie, right? Did he do any sort of drugs? I mean, I've never heard of him getting psychedelic himself.
No, he didn't. He shunned it. I think if you read his book, he talks about, I guess he fought in Korea in the 50s and, or served, I don't know if he fought, but he served in Korea in the 50s, and there was one time where he got drunk, and it was a real bad experience for him, and he swore off, he never drank or took any kind of drugs whatsoever after that, nothing.
That's
so, yeah, he kept it clean. However, you've probably seen it's popping up all over the internet. I first saw this picture a couple of years ago, and it blew my mind. It's a picture of Hal, I guess from the early 70s, where his hair was a little bushier, a little longer, and he's wearing a tie-dye T-shirt. It just seemed out of character, but that, I think that was his only concession to the hippie movement.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of, there's so many records, you really can't talk about them all, there just isn't enough time, but I've got a list here of records that were in the top 10 that Hal played on, and I just want to list a few, sort of as a tribute to Hal, sort of because I think when you talk about Hal, it's kind of mind-blowing, and the way to blow people's minds is to just keep listing records over and over and over, and people are like, you're kidding me, it just seems too many records to be true, but it is true. So I'm going to name some records that Hal played on that went into the top 10. And Dennis, stop me if you have anything to say about the record at all, or about the drum groove, or about anything, just how awesome the records are. Can't Help Falling in Love by Elvis's 1961 went to number one. Might be Hal's first number one record.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that. Sounds about right.
It's kind of interesting because Elvis recorded a lot. He made, you know, 8 million movies, and they all have songs in them recorded in Hollywood. He was definitely making his best records in Memphis or in Nashville, and the sort of soundtrack records are not the best songs he recorded, but he did record a lot in California, and almost always with Hal, right?
Well, starting in the early 60s, he actually did a lot of recording in Hollywood in the 50s, too. And he did make some really killer sides in Hollywood, but I'd say from 61 moving forward, I think you're right. I think it was probably all Hal.
The Crystals, He's a Rebel, number one, of course. The whole Phil Spector sound has so much to do with Hal.
Yep.
Bobby Darin, 18 Yellow Roses. I never even heard that record, but I number 10. Surf City by Jan and Dean, number one.
I was just going to say, the interesting thing about Surf City and quite a few of the Jan and Gene records certainly was Hal, but he had Jan Berry had Hal and Earl Palmer set up in the studio, and he cut two drummers at once on those tracks.
You know, once I learned that, I went back and listened, and you can absolutely hear that.
There's one compilation where they play where they offer the tracks only, a CD compilation where you can hear without the vocals, and you could hear slight flamming, you know, between the snares.
It's a little messier, yeah. Well, here's one that I always, I know Hal didn't play with this guy a lot, but Another Saturday Night by Sam Cooke. It has those sort of amazing fills in it, you know, that are sort of Fred Flintstone feet sounding. Great record, that is.
That is great, and yes, you're right, that is totally Hal. But Hal actually did play with Sam Cooke also on the Nightbeat album, considered by to be maybe Sam's finest album. And I was kind of surprised because I listened to that album last year. I said, boy, this is so great. And I thought for sure it was Earl Palmer. And maybe Earl played on one or two tracks, but most of that record is Hal.
I believe you can hear Hal counting that song off, or you can hear some, you know, there's like an outtake where you can hear, because he's the drummer, that's kind of one wonderful thing, is that on a lot of outtakes you hear Hal's voice counting off records, you know, some of your favorite records. Surfing USA.
Tell that to Gary Lewis, because you hear him count off on on this diamond ring, and I think count me in.
Yes, absolutely, you can. It's unmistakable. The Beach Boys, Surfing USA, Be True to Your School, Surfer Girl, okay, Little Douche Coop.
Let me stop you. Let me stop you. He's not on Surfing USA.
Who's the drummer on Surfing USA? And why isn't it
Frank
Hal?
DeVito. Frank DeVito. I don't know, but it's documented. David Marks of the Beach Boys told me Dennis was supposed to do the session, but apparently he hurt his ankle. He fell and hurt his ankle. Why not Hal? Maybe they needed to cut the session. Hal wasn't available. This guy, Frank DeVito, who's still around, later became the regular drummer in the Baja Marimba Band, is the drummer on Surfing USA. And I got to say, it plagued me for years because it really kind of has Dennis's feel, but I thought it was a little too slick to be Dennis, and it didn't really sound like Hal to me either. Then I finally learned that it was Frank DeVito. I read about an interview with him, and David Marks told me.
Also from 63, A Christmas Gift for You from Phil Spector. That record is, in some ways, you know, the thing we'll just hear forever. You know, that is one of the most known records anybody ever played on. Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime from Dean Martin, number one. So he would go from playing with, you know, Jan and Dean to Dean Martin, different Dean.
Yeah.
Lauren Green, Ringo, number one. 1964, lots of Beach Boys hits. The Hondells, the Marquettes, the Ripcords, Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction, like you said, which was number one. Gary Lewis and the Playboys, This Diamond Ring, where you can hear Hal. It's definitely Hal on Taste of Honey for Herb Albert, right?
Yeah, that certainly is. And let me interrupt another thing for a second. And I was talking about this on Sue Braun's show yesterday. Okay, so Hal probably has on his discography, I Get Around. Do you see that in front of you? Hal played on that record. And Hal did not play drums, though. He played percussion on that record. Dennis played drums. The reason I know it's because it's on the session tapes that came out on bootlegs. You hear it's Dennis playing drums, but Hal is on percussion. And I think it's the same thing for Dance, Dance, Dance. So there's another way for mistakes to be made or misinterpretations to be made.
Yeah, I think Hal is playing whatever those 16th notes thing on I Get Around, I think.
Yeah. He like brushes on timbales or something like that.
Yeah. He plays on the Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man. Bobby Darin, If I Was a Carpenter. Bob Lind, Elusive Butterfly. Frank Sinatra, That's Life, Strangers in the Night. Poor Side of Town, Secret Agent Man from Johnny Rivers. Boots Are Made for Walking. My Love, Petula Clark. I know she did record some in Hollywood. Did that sound like Hal to you?
Yes. Oh, it's totally Hal. Around that period, she started recording in L.A. I guess Tony Hatch wanted that hit sound, you know, and a lot of her records moving forward were from that period were cut in Hollywood. That's right. And it's total Wrecking Crew.
And you always think of Simon and Garfunkel as a New York thing, but Hal's on a lot of that stuff. Did they fly him to New York? Did they come to L.A.? What's the deal?
Again, I think, I don't know about some of that early stuff. I think there's some mistakes in the discography. I know that some of the early Simon and Garfunkel stuff was cut in New York, but I can't be sure what was cut where. I know they did record in Hollywood a bit, too.
But I think they did fly him to New York at some point.
Yep, it was for the Bridge Over Troubled Water sessions. I think he said to me that was the only time he recorded in New York, I think. So we're talking around 1970, yeah.
That's amazing. He only recorded in New York that one time. That's incredible. I guess why leave if he was so busy?
That's it. And that's why he didn't go on the road hardly at all after he was entrenched in the studio scene, because you're on call every day. People want you, you know, so you can't fight the hand that feeds you. And I think he would end up making more money in the studio than he would on the road anyway.
Also, you don't want to let Jim Gordon or Jim Keltner get your jobs, and then they sort of, you know, forget about you. You know, you got to stay number one. Yeah,
that's right.
The Association, which is such Hal music to me. You know, that is just such a great, what you said earlier, a great example of a band who had a perfectly good drummer, but Hal just sort of came in and killed it. Wouldn't It Be Nice and Good Vibrations, Mamas and the Papas. again, just such Hal music to me. And Monday, Monday, California Dream, and It's Our Again Last Night, all huge hits. And then here's one, the Sandpipers, Guantanamera, number 9 in 66. It's possible, right? The T-Bones, No Matter What Shape, the Batman theme, which is, of course...
The T-Bone record is so happening. When I was a kid, there's a drum break, I guess it's coming out of the bridge or going into a break, where he just does like a four-bar little figure, and I would lift the needle off and just play it over and over and over. What a cool record that is.
And you know they made that record in 5 minutes, right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, something they, you know, a Brian Wilson labored over production. You know, they just went in and did it, I'm sure.
I think you're right. And if that's a cool album, too. That whole album is pretty great, that instrumental album, No Matter What Shape Your Stomach's In by the T-Bones. And my guess is they probably did the whole album in two or three sessions, you know, maybe even in one day.
Yeah, I've got that album. It's terrific. Moving on to 67, more Bobby V, Frank and Nancy, Something Stupid, which I love that record. I just love it. Paul Revere and the Raiders, Him or Me, What's It Gonna Be? Scott McKenzie, Wear Flowers. Oh, this is the year we already talked about, didn't it? So we've heard all these already, but including Love Forever Changed.
Okay, I'll say that that was one. He didn't go on the road per se, but they did fly him up to be the house drummer at the Monterey Pop Festival in '67, and he played with Scott McKenzie, Laura Nero, Johnny Rivers, and the Mamas and No. He didn't play with the Mamas and Papas. That was Eddie Ho played with Moms and Pops at Monterey, and maybe one other artist. But I did interview Hal about that, the year 1967, and I asked him, and this is interesting, I asked him, oh, the Who, you know, what did you think of Keith Moon? Because I don't know what Hal's take would have been on Keith. Oh, I loved Keith, you know. that I saw him at Monterey, and I loved all the drama and theatrics, and... and we became good friends. And I think the other reason that that Hal liked Keith so much is because Keith was very vocal about his respect and love for Hal. You know, I just thought it was great to hear him talk about Keith Moon. As a matter of fact, I saw him. I would run into him because we leased our cars from the same place. Anyway,
great Hal impression, by the way.
I'll toot my own horn here. One time, a friend of mine, John DeChristopher, was working at Zildjian and was good friends with Hal. And this is in the 90s. And I called up John and left a voicemail. Hey, John, it's Hal calling. No big deal. Just wanted to check in. No need to call me back. And so I totally faked him out. He bought it. He thought it was Hal.
That's great. You can't do that anymore, I'm afraid. Yeah. That's 1968. Gary Puck and the Union Gap. Richard Harris's MacArthur Park, which is such a huge, huge record.
And that's the one that Hal always cites as his favorite.
Really?
MacArthur Park. Yeah. And with the Union Gap, he played on, I think, maybe their earliest record. Then the later ones were done by Jim Gordon. But MacArthur Park, I guess because there's so much adventure on one side of a 45, and I think the legend is they did it in one take, so I think he's very proud of that. And no matter what you think of that song, I think it's a fabulous track, just a fabulous track.
A Little Less Conversation from Elvis is from 68, and he uses that same drum beat on a Fifth Dimension tune.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you which one it is.
Yeah, I can't either off the top of my head.
I mean, there's similarities at the on the second half of Aquarius Let the Sunshine In. There's that kind of feel to it.
Yes, there is. I guess that was going around. Yeah, what a great, great cut that is. And A Little Less Conversation was it number one in, what, you know, 30 years, 40 years later when they did that remix?
If not, it probably was. It got a lot of traction when it came back, yeah, the remix. That's another Hal Mark moment for him, you know, because he got some ink all those years later with that. He was very happy about that. But in 67, I mean, I love house playing even going back to 62, 63. But come 67, 68, 69, and a lot of times he was working with Joe Osborne on bass, and he is just so on it. House playing is so happening at that time. He just grew as a player, you know, and the stuff he's doing, like listen to the Association album Birthday, or the song Everything That Touches You, or some of the tracks on that album, or that Fifth Dimension stuff, or anything from that era. He's so swinging and just full of vitality and imagination, and you could hear his technique. And I've never been a guy I marvel at somebody's technique, but it's not what makes a great record for me. But you hear how he's using his technique to do cool stuff. Anyway, that period is really always well worth investigating.
Oh, I totally agree with you. He grew, and I totally agree that when he started to play regularly with Joe Osborne and not Carole Kaye, and Carole Kaye, nothing against her bass work, but they kind of got a little funkier almost and a little more together as a unit, and a little more, there's a lot more surprises in that era from the rhythm section. Yeah, even on some like the Carpenters records and stuff, there's just some crazy stuff going on with the bass and drums, you know, just, you know, which makes me happy when I listen to that stuff. He plays on Tommy Roe Dizzy, which is a big drum record. Of course, we mentioned...
I was just going to say, that record is a great example of a couple things. First, the fidelity is as good as a record can sound in terms of just sheer sonic brilliance. You know, it's everything is in its place, and it's so well recorded. The drumming on that is so spot on, right? You know how producers will try to use a click track to make things so super tight, but you can never get that human tight feel. I mean, the feel on that record and just what he's playing is such perfection, but it feels like a human.
Oh, it's a little bit laid back. It's not jerky at all. Yeah, yeah, it's groovy. Yeah,
it's so happening. You know, it's just so happening. Yeah, that record blows my mind. It just blows my mind.
Steve Barry production. Aquarius Let the Sunshine In, which is one of like what a 45 that is. You know what I mean? That's just a mind blowing record. Yeah, it's just great. Exactly.
You know, I think what you said is true. What you said is true, that things got more active in the playing when he teamed up with Joe Osborne. I think they pushed each other. You know, I think it was a great partnership. Then they really took it up a notch from playing with each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. He plays on all those, not all those, but he plays on a lot of Neil Diamond records. Another guy you think of as East Coast, but a lot of those records have Hal on them.
The later ones, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, the Carpenters, a lot of hits, mostly with Hal. And then we get into sort of the late 70s, and I didn't realize David Cassidy's version of Cherish went to number 9, and some Barbra Streisand records, Andy Williams records. One of my all-time favorite records, and maybe it's just because I remember it from being a kid, but Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds' Don't Pull Your Love, which has that sort of fill that starts out the record, starts on the hi-hat. It's just like it's one of the air drum records of all time. I love that record.
Let's go back and listen to that one. It's been a while.
Oh, it's one of my favorites. Partridge Family, I Think I Love You, number one hit. And then sort of, you know, it sort of tapers off. We sort of talked about the end earlier. He does also play on a couple, I think, at least one Steely Dan tune somewhere in the mix. And then he sort of took off with John Denver and was his road guy for a while. And then I think he sort of retired mostly, right, after that?
I think he was still doing a fair amount. Again, I was looking through these letters from the 80s and even early 90s, and he was saying that he was living in Marina Del Rey for a while on a houseboat. And he said, I go into Hollywood about 3 times a week. I'm still doing jingles and TV themes and movie stuff. So I think he was working pretty much certainly not as much as he was in the 60s and 70s, but in the 80s, I'm pretty sure he was still fairly active.
I didn't know that. Wow. I also didn't know he was living on a houseboat.
Yeah, and no, he wasn't making big hit records, although we should make note of the Captain and Tennille record.
Oh, yeah.
Love Will Keep. Which I guess... the thing we failed to mention was that he had those Grammy records of the years consecutively from 65 through 70, I think it was, which is another unassailable thing about Hal. I mean, it's just incredible that he's the guy that was on the Grammy records, number one records of the year for 5 years in a row.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know? Yeah, I did another podcast where I reran my 2007 interview with Hal, which was the last podcast folks heard before this one. And I talked about that quite a bit in that. So maybe that's why I laid off it here. But yes, it is amazing that he is the thread of five in a row records that won the best. I mean, it's just a mind blowing. And I believe their Taste of Honey for Herb Albert, Strangers in the Night for Frank Sinatra, Up, Up and Away for Fifth Dimension, Mrs. Robinson for Simon and Garfunkel, Aquarius Let the Sunshine for Fifth Dimension, and then Bridge Over Troubled Waters for Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, it's amazing that he was the sound. And he, did he win one of those for Glenn Campbell, maybe one of the other years? Or?
Yeah. After Bridge Over Troubled Water, then I think he skipped a year or two and then got another one for the Captain and Tennille record, and then flash forward to, 3 years ago or whenever it was, where the Wrecking Crew were reunited for that Glenn Campbell session. I'm Not Gonna Miss You, I think was the name of the record. And that became the Grammy number one record of the year. And he was really, really proud of that. You know, he told me that however many years later it was that, He was incredulous. You know, it meant so much to him. And I'm so glad that he had that honor again later in life. I was so pleased to hear that.
Just the best guy. Have we missed anything? Is there anything people need to know about Hal Blaine that we have not covered or talked about, or a piece of work of his that's, you know, and we've talked about tons of records and tons, but this is really, you know, there's tons of records that nobody ever heard and lots of jingles and, you know, movie pieces and stuff like that. But anything about him or about his work, Dennis, that we need to talk about before we go here?
As I'll just be repeating myself. I just think he was a guy that injected the joy of life into his playing. I really think that's the secret of the success of those records and why we still listen to them and want to listen to them and why we feel great when we hear them come on the car radio. I just think... the other thing about Hal is he did study. He went to the Roy Knapp School of Percussion in the 50s and studied his craft pretty seriously after he got the GI Bill. And then before he got in the studio scene in L.A., he did spend time in Vegas and on the road with Patti Page and Tommy Sands. And I think somebody else, and he went to Australia with Tommy Sands in late 50s, early 60s. So he had already, and also when he was studying at the Roy Knapp School in Chicago, he was playing strip clubs at night. He was getting a lot of experience. And he was very quick to point out to me, in those days it wasn't pornographic. These girls they were married, they had kids, it wasn't pornographic and this blah, blah, blah. So he played strip clubs. And then he got a gig, again, later in the 50s or early 60s in San Bernardino playing in a house band that backed up the celebrities that came through town, like even doing rim shots for comedians like Don Rickles. He was very close with Lenny Bruce in those days. So he I guess you could say paid his dues, but he got a lot of practical learning from playing gigs, and that's when that was real showbiz. You're playing with real singers and real. You had to read, and you had to be on your game. And Hal had that all in his pocket before he even hit the studios and started making hit after hit. You know.
Yeah, I think the ability to read is something that is sort of overlooked in what made the Wrecking Crew so efficient, is that, you know, except for Glenn Campbell, they could all read music, and a lot of that stuff, at least lead sheets or something, was written, and it helped them cut, you know, that many tracks that quickly. Because I think some people just assume they just were a rock band who just, you know, made it up or whatever.
Yeah. Right. No, that's a very good point. And in some cases, it was just lead sheets or chord sheets. And again, it's so hard to imagine the enormity of the volume of work they were doing and what that brings to you as a player and as an ensemble. Because, again, you're pretty much working with the same people day after day. So you create this... cohesiveness, but and in instincts that enable you to know where to go when you're cutting a track. You can anticipate where your bass player is going to do something, or what Leon Russell is going to interject on the piano or the organ. So such a well-oiled machine, because you're playing day after day so many hours, and you can't help but be on your game and just know what the heck to do.
Yeah. What song should we go get out of here with? What do you want to hear?
Out of Limits.
Okay. Okay, great.
I don't know. That's the first thing that came to mind.
No, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. Tommy Tedesco on guitar. Great record. It's funny because the riff is... the guitar riff sounds like it's inspired by the Twilight Zone, right? And yet they kind of do it for the title. They do a twist on Outer Limits, which was the other
Twilight Zone ripoff show,
sci-fi fantasy show of that era. It's just funny. It's great. How can you say it's so cool? But what a great track. What a great track.
I was listening back to my interview with Hal, and he was talking about how Glenn Campbell couldn't read music, and they were cutting, I think it is Dance, 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 and it's a pretty complicated guitar intro, you know, and Glenn Campbell kept screwing it up, and you hear Hal Blaine say, "Should we call Tommy Tedesco?"
So great.
Yeah,
you do hear on some of those outtakes more of Hal's humor and jokes, and I think that was a great thing to be able to do, to cut the tension in the studio, because the studio, you know, sessions, you're under the gun. These guys are doing 3-hour sessions, and they're expected, maybe not so much for a Beach Boys session, because Brian, I think, took more time with them, but in general, to cut 2 to 4 tracks in 3 hours. So there's a lot of pressure going on, and Hal was able to really lighten the load with his humor, which is a great attribute, and I think went a long way to further his career as well.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, always a pleasure to talk with you just about music of any kind, but I know Hal was close to you, and I know he's a friend. You know, I'm sorry that you lost your friend, and I'm sorry that the world has lost, you know, somebody who just touched us all so much, whether we know it or not. You know, he's his music, like you said, is there's no way he hasn't touched you. It made you smile, you know, something. So I appreciate you taking some of your time to sort of share all of this 2 cents with us today. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. It's true. It's sometimes I had to pinch myself just to, when I would think that, this guy is my friend. It's not, you know, I guess I was going through this folder today. I have a lot of correspondence from him, and he cared about people. He cared about what he did, and long live Hal Blaine.
Yeah, long live Hal Blaine forever. I mean, longer than forever. We'll be listening to this stuff forever. It's just so right on. Yeah, it's amazing too.
Oh, there's another good choice. That's another good choice for the closing song. It is Forever, the Beach Boys track. He plays the monster kid on that track.
Huh.
All right. He played 2 outros.
Maybe I'll sneak in. thanks, Dennis. I'm sure I'll cross paths with you soon. And you can check Dennis's DJing archives at WFMU. And, of course, keep in touch with the Smithereens, who are still going strong.
And, yeah, man. I'm heading out tomorrow, actually, matter of fact, to the Midwest.
All right. Be safe, and I will talk with you soon. Let's hear Out of Limits.
All right, Mikey. Thanks for having me.
Just begun to live, white lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way. Before the rising sun we fly, to choose. We start out walking and learn to run. Sharing horizons that are new to us. Watching the signs along the way. When the evening comes, we smile. So much of life ahead. We'll find a place where there's room to grow. Sharing horizons that are new to us. Watching the signs along the way. Talking it over, just the two of us. Working together day to day. Together. Together. And when the evening comes, we smile. Place where there's room to grow, and yes, we've just begun.
love I have for you. Live in your heart and be forever.